Hello and welcome to, we're back, Sherry, at our regular time. We've had to our guests, we've been actually broadcasting at other times to accommodate our guests. And thank you so much for meeting our original time schedule, Thursday mornings, 8 o'clock. That's the time we started, and we deviated for a couple of weeks. But we are back, and we are back with a big, big show that we promised our audience, what, 6 weeks ago?
A long time ago.
Vaccines Part 2, with two great doctors in the house. We were going to call them Doctor and Doctor, but then it reminded me of the Three Stooges, where we go, Doctor, 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 Doctor. But we have, we'll talk about our guests in a second, but I just want to welcome Sherry Salas, my co-host here, and we're excited to get this going really quickly. This portion of our show is sponsored by Premier sponsor Elevated Roofing and our regular sponsor Porsche Plano. And here we are on Thursday to start talking about vaccines. And we have with us today Dr. Dirk, we'll call him Dirk Rodriguez, right? And Dr. Jim Meehan, who came all the way from Tulsa. Dr. Dirk Rodriguez came to us from Dallas. Thank you so much for traveling. And we're going to give you a couple minutes to start, just a couple minutes about yourself and then your position on this topic, and then we'll get the discussion going. So, Dirk, why don't you start us off?
All right. Well, thank you. Thanks for having me here. I really do appreciate it. First question I have is, one of your sponsors is Porsche Plano. So do we each get a Porsche when we are down here?
Well, you'll hear how great they are, and maybe you should go to Porsche Plano on Plano well Parkway said. and see the great team that's over there. But that's a great question. But unfortunately, no, we did actually give a small model Porsche to someone once, but we didn't give him a car.
Okay. Well, if it's one of those like a Hot Wheels, I'll take it to my grandson.
We might be able to get you that.
Okay. Well, thanks for having me here. The topic of vaccinations to me is always fascinating. And having been a flight surgeon and military surgeon for the United States Air Force and having pretty much traveled the world, one of the things that I got to experience firsthand was seeing the absence of vaccinations and the effect that vaccinations have, or the lack of vaccinations have, as well as the impact that they have on communities and populations. The diseases that vaccinations have been able to affect, and the effect here in the United States, at least since the 1900s, has been significant regarding the reduction of deaths and disabilities. So I'm always interested when I hear people say they are against vaccines. And what I like to think is that they're not against vaccines, they're against the potential problems that vaccines can cause, which we know is a reality. And my stance as a doctor, as a person, as a father, as a grandfather has always been to balance what a lot of people use as a cliche, the risks versus the benefits, but those are a reality. And the other thing that I'll always like to talk about and go back to all the time is the science, if we're going to use that term of vaccine versus non-vaccine. And so my point is that the important thing of vaccines is for all parents out there is, number one, educate yourself. Number two, read the science on both sides. And number three, ultimately, talk to your doctor. Because while vaccines are important, and there is a schedule that's out there for children and adults to receive vaccines, it's not written in stone. It can be varied. And so be your own best advocate for you and your children's health.
Okay, that's a quick introduction. And Jim, how would you like to say a little about yourself and,
yeah,
and your position?
Well, my name is Jim Meehan. I'm a medical doctor, MD. I attended the United States Military Academy at West Point.
And thank you both for being there.
Yeah,
thank
you. Yes.
I didn't serve as long as Dr. Dirk did, but thank you for your service. You've done a lot for this country, and I really admire that. Both of us took an oath to serve and protect, to defend the citizens of this country from enemies, both foreign and domestic. And I think we have a domestic enemy in the pharmaceutical company at times, and pharmaceutical companies, and we need to be careful about that. But a little,
if I may, just, you're welcome. regarding the issue of the service, but very few people understand how much damn fun I had when I was serving.
Yeah, right. That's good stuff.
Let's keep it on the service side.
Yeah. So I attended University of Oklahoma for medical school. I chose to go into ophthalmology, eye surgery. Trained at one of the top institutions in the United States at Washington University in St. Louis.
Very good school.
Great school and great training. And during that time, I also served as a medical editor of the Journal of Ocular Inflammation and Immunology. So I have a good background in inflammation and immunology. I practiced in that area in eye care for a long time. Did a lot of surgeries, about 10,000 surgeries, LASIK, cataract surgery. But I really got frustrated with a broken healthcare system that I think is so focused on the treatment of end stages of disease, not enough on prevention. So I actually refocused my career more on prevention, preventive strategies to prevent disease from occurring. Unfortunately, our healthcare system just doesn't pay for that. They don't pay for preventive measures, or those that they do consider preventive measures are pretty questionable. And there's some issues. I think we're going to talk about some of those issues with vaccinations. We're going to talk about really important issues. We've already found some common ground. We agree that we want to be educated. I want parents to be very well educated. Unfortunately, you have a lot of censorship going on in the mainstream media and on social media, where the voices that many people call anti-vaccination are being silenced. And I think we have to be concerned about any issue being silenced, because some majority thinks that it is an issue that is not worthy of discussion and debate. That's not the country we live in. That's not the country that Dr. Dirk and I agreed to serve and protect. I think both of us would stand up and defend anybody's right to speak freely. So that's my issue in the vaccination debate. It's about educating, being able to have free and open debate, and about informed informed consent.
I'm supposed to ding because we have common ground.
We did have common ground. And
nice.
Thank you, Dr. Dirk.
And what Jim said is absolutely true. That's what made this country great, is debate and compromise. And that's the reason why Sherry and I really wanted to pursue this show, because we wanted to reach common goal. And that's why our tagline is, we discuss, you decide. And that's a very good point that you bring up, Jim. And I know that Dirk would like to respond to some of those things, because I saw him make a little note there. So what do you have to say, Dirk?
You know, it's... I suppose it's the issue. I have a problem with absolutism, meaning that you are either A or B. And to follow up on Jim's introduction, besides being a surgeon, I went to a school of tropical medicine in the Caribbean that very much specialized in preventive health care as well as tropical diseases. And this was in Puerto Rico. And what very few people know about Puerto Rico is that, besides being a commonwealth of the United States, that's where Walter Reed started his seminal work on malaria, which he subsequently perfected in Panama. And if it weren't for the United States Army, there wouldn't have been a medical school in Puerto Rico, and there would have been a lot of deaths related to different disease processes.
Wow.
And on top of that, you heard me say that I was in the United States Air Force. I served in sub-Saharan Africa, as well as the Saudi Arabia continent, the Arabian continent. And the important thing that Jim said here was the issue of censure that I will disagree with. I think there are people out there who are absolutists, who don't want to hear the other side, and I think that's a huge mistake. The good thing about Jim and I and our generation was that we grew up in a period of time where the science of medicine was foremost, and we debated either side. And Jim and I grew up in a training scenario and situation called, we had a conference called M&M, Morbidity and Mortality. And you had to stand up as a doctor. You had to explain what happened to your patient or patients. You had to defend your treatment, and you had to see both sides of it. And it was a wonderful scientific exchange, because there was never, ever really an agreement. What there was an agreement of research or further science. Regarding censure, I'll disagree, Jim. I think that the neatest thing that has happened has been the internet, regardless of who we think created it or used it.
And maybe Gore didn't create the internet? Are you trying to tell me, Dirk?
Yeah, well, I'll leave that for further scientific discussion. But, you know, social media, social media, internet is really great, because I think it's opened up more avenues for more thought processes. And to quote the late astrophysicist Dr. Carl Sagan, the science that we have now is the best science we have until better science comes along. The point of that is, as scientists, what we are constantly doing is we are challenging what is out there. That's our duty. That is our role.
So you agree that there should be debate on this topic?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Oh, it should because constantly be evolving.
I mean, Sherry and I, you know, that the show is on, we started the show and here we are, 12 minutes in. We had a very difficult time getting a doctor that would speak about the pro-vaccine portion because they didn't want to give a platform for the other side, which we were like, you know, there's so much pro-vaccine propaganda and, you know, influence out there. I mean, even in our schools, and we couldn't believe that we couldn't get anybody. And we really appreciate you coming on and at least saying we should discuss both sides, because that's what this show is about. Like I just said, discussing both sides. So I know that Jim was writing some notes, so let him respond to some of the things that you said.
Yeah, so there is this issue of censorship. I don't know how sensitive to it you are, but being on this side of the debate, it's a big issue. So I'm a pariah in medicine for coming out and questioning vaccines. They are the unquestionable, the science is settled. The number of times that that has been said, which is directly counter to what it sounds like your stance is, Dirk, and I agree with you 100%. The science is never settled, but that is the position of the pro-vaccine movement right now. It's to silence, suppress. I've been sued by a pediatrician in Oklahoma.
Yeah, but hold on, let me jump in here. Do you think, because I read up a lot on some of this stuff and the lawsuits and everything, do you think some of that doesn't stem from a desire to just make the people that have an opinion be quiet? Or do you think that is because to some degree they have more to lose and they're bound by so much more ethically than someone who's just saying, I don't like it? A doctor has their profession and their career and their license on the line if they make one move in the wrong direction. Is that not at all part of, do you think that could be part of the argument?
Well, no, it's actually, I don't think that if you're referring to like the pediatricians or doctors that provide vaccines, their license is not on the line. Their livelihood is not on the line. They are protected from, they're immune to liability. They cannot be sued if the vaccines they provide injure or kill a child.
No, that's not really what I meant. But okay. I mean, like,
let's talk about that.
So, Dirk, what do you think about that? That there is no culpability for the big pharma, since I think it was in Reagan's presidency that they signed, again, excuse my ignorance,
1983.
Thank you.
1986. It's a National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act.
Thank you. So, it kind of raises an outsider looking in saying, hey, why are they protected so much against any type of liability?
Well, let's qualify that.
Okay.
Jim's point is correct. And in our country, Jim's point is correct from the perspective that the pediatricians, the physicians in the exercise of their duty, based on what any other reasonable and illogical person would do in the same type of circumstance, they are really not immune, but they are protected. Now, Big Pharma is not protected, right? If they make mistakes, they are certainly liable. And one of the things, and this year I'm going to show my age, the Cutter incident of 1955 with the mistake made with polio vaccines. After the wonderful discovery and, you know, the near eradication of polio, once the government stepped in and said, okay, all you companies make polio vaccines with, hand it out, the Cutter Company made a huge mistake, and there were over 100 deaths. There were something like 10,000 polio cases after 20 years of intense research to try to not cure but avoid polio. And so there is liability. The doctors are doing what they need to do or what they feel is necessary to protect their patients based on the science that they have. Jim, I will disagree with you. I don't think the science is settled. Okay. I'll disagree with you.
And so you're actually agreeing with me, because what I'm saying is that the pro-vaccine movement says the science is settled. Vaccines do not cause autism. The science is settled. Vaccines are safe and effective. That's their position. I'm arguing against that. So it sounds like we agree. I will hit the, I will hit the bell.
Well, I do agree from the perspective that the science is never, ever settled.
Right.
I was going to say, somebody jump in because I can't, because I'm not a doctor and I don't agree.
Now, if we're going to get into the issue of autism in vaccines, mm-hmm. I will disagree with you vehemently. And the issue at hand is that right now, I'm going to use a really big term, so I'm sorry for everybody. The cytopathological studies available out there do not support the link between autism and vaccines. And so the issue at hand, and what that means is when we've looked at the tissues of folks who have had autism, we are not finding a link to any of the components related to the vaccine. Now, that doesn't mean that the science hasn't been settled as to what happens in the uterus, what happens early on. And we are still studying that actively. And because of the Vaccine Injury Act, and because of Dr. Wakefield's paper, a supposed paper, now retracted and demonized paper in 1998, it set off a wonderful round of science of which we've discovered so much more, and we're doing so much more research into the difficulty of the spectrum of autism.
Right.
Jim, yeah, why don't you talk about...
Yeah, oh, I love that. That one's loaded with lots of responses. So I will say that vaccines do cause autism, because I will say that the National Vaccine Court had determined it so. One case in particular is called the Hannah Pauling case. And that was a case that was found that she had a mitochondrial disorder, which is a very common disorder. As much as 40-50% of the population might have that disorder. And the Hannah Pauling case was a case that was decided as that the vaccine caused that injury. Her case was really unique because she had a father that was a neurologist, very educated and very persistent in pursuing the case at the vaccine court system. So vaccines do cause autism. They have been found to do so. But the thing, what we get kind of caught up in the term of autism
is... Just for our audience. Mm-hmm. So when you say it was determined it did cause autism in her, was that just decided by the court or was that decided by the science also?
Well, Julie Gerberding, the director of the CDC at the time, in an interview with Sanjay Gupta, said as much in that interview. It's online. Everybody can search it, and therefore they can confirm, you know, they can make their own decision on who's got the issue nailed down. And I'll tell you, I've studied this deeply. You can't be on the side that I'm on in medicine and not have really checked your facts.
Okay.
As a former medical editor, I'm really careful about these things. So that's the issue. The issue with autism is it's a broad spectrum. There's a lot of kids that are lumped into that, and they have it's a diversity of
right.
We don't know what causes it. You know, there is no genetic determinants that have absolutely been nailed down. We keep looking for them. That's where most of the money is going. But it's one of the things that will result in autism looking a spectrum of symptoms that look like autism is encephalopathy. It's inflammation in the brain. And to counter Dr. Dirk, what you said is that there is science that shows a pathological mechanism for the creation of encephalopathy from vaccines. And that pathological agent is an ingredient in vaccines that is the aluminum adjuvant. And the aluminum has been shown by preeminent aluminum researcher, Dr. Christopher Exley. He's the doctor that identified the pathology between aluminum and Alzheimer's and has has identified aluminum being translocated to the brain, found in the brain of autistic children that died on pathology examination. Extraordinarily high levels. Aluminum should not be in the brain.
So I read this also, and I read some information that said the aluminum that is in the vaccines is not the same as the element. So explain that to me. There's a difference in the element of aluminum and something about aluminum salts. Is there a difference?
Go ahead, Jack.
Absolutely.
Please? Your question is a really, really tough one. And the issue.
Way to go, Sherry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, it's not that, because that could be a completely different show. And just like when I start discussing, polynomial variables in a regressional analysis, I can empty a room and everybody just falls asleep.
That's what I was thinking when Sherry said that, way to go.
It's a big deal, the argument.
It is.
This,
indeed,
however, this particular aluminum is actually a very big portion.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Amongst scientists, and I'll try not to speak for you, it's axiomatic that we understand that not all aluminum or mercury is the same. The problem is that in the lay public, that fact is subsumed by all the shouting and all the yelling, and we don't hear it. From the aspect of editorials and peer review and all that other stuff, there is faults there, because Lancet would not have been caught with his pants down regarding Dr. Wakefield. Dr. Exley, who you talk about, aluminum, the issue at hand is that his work has been looked at, and when he published his work, the five brain specimens in which he found high doses of aluminum, when they were subjected to reanalysis, they could not find the same variables or the same results. And one of the specimens in which it was found had the highest level, when it was reanalyzed again, came back at zero. And, you know, I don't like putting down colleagues or anything like that, but the investigations regarding Dr. Wakefield are out there and in the internet. And unfortunately, Dr. Exley has lost his funding and has had to go to GoFundMe type projects so that he can continue his investigation. So the one thing about science and the science, any science whatsoever, is that when a colleague comes out and makes a statement, there has to be a hypothesis or theory behind it, even if it's just a single finding. And one of the things that we like to do as scientists is we say, okay, great, Jim has found this. Can Dirk now find this in his laboratory under, you know, the same set of circumstances? That's called reproducibility. And that's the basis upon which a lot of people have said, you know what, we've reproduced these findings regarding vaccines, or the absence of findings regarding vaccines, and it's been done so in thousands of cases. And to Jim's point regarding Dr. Exley and in analyzing the brains of people who have autism, which are now in the thousands, not the five that Dr. Exley had in his paper, it's in the thousands, we have yet to find aluminum or mercury present or their byproducts present. Regarding aluminum, and to your point, Sherry, aluminum is the third most common element in the world, and we are exposed to that every single day, mostly through breathing.
Deodorant.
Women give it to their children.
Don't put it
milk
under your arms, please.
And the thing is, when we talk about aluminum in the brain, the body burden of aluminum, the majority of it is in our skin, in our bones, and only 1% is located in the brain. And so we're able to eliminate that quite well. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't be working to limit that, but right now we've been exposed to it for millions of years.
All right, thanks, Doug. I don't use aluminum deodorant.
I don't either.
Okay, but go ahead. I know, Jen.
Yeah,
I'm
chomping at the bit. So that was a long list of things that need to be responded to. number one, that the reexamination of the Exley data. Do you know who funded that? One thing I do as a medical editor is that I dig in and look for bias in articles. Reanalysis was funded by pharma. And 85% of the medical research today is being funded by pharma. The preclinical trials are being funded and sponsored by pharma. Vioxx, that killed 60,000 people, injured 500,000, is a Merck product. It was the preclinical trials. It was all sponsored and funded by Merck. They lied about the data. This is court records. They ended up paying almost $5 billion in settlement claims for the 60,000 people that were injured by that drug. They in the trial, they were found guilty of suppressing information in the preclinical trials that showed an increased risk of heart attack and stroke, and they suppressed it. And then when they had objectors, when doctors were starting to find the bodies piling up that injuries were being caused, Merck in internal documents said, we will attack them where they live. It's called Wakefielding nowadays. The Wakefield case, Wakefield, by the way, was one of 12 authors. The other 12 authors never lost their license. In fact, John Walker Smith, who actually fought it in court, had it completely reversed.
Are those doctors?
Yeah, they were all doctors.
Okay. In the United Kingdom.
Yeah, they got them on an ethical technicality.
They're still doctors.
They got them on an ethical technicality. It was a 12-case report. He was the watcher on the wall that identified the prevalence of gut inflammation associated with MMR vaccine. What's happened since then? It's been confirmed by at least 27 studies. UC Davis has pointed to the same thing. The problem is in this debate is that if you come out on that side, you get attacked where you live, just like Merck said. By the way, Merck is the number one maker or manufacturer of vaccines in the world. in the United States, they have a have it locked down. Their MMR vaccine is protected by patent.
Well, let me jump in, though, because my very, very dedicated work to get someone secured for the Provax side of this show, I will tell you, hands down, that was the first response from everybody is, if we can't do this because the reality is they'll get death threats. I mean, it's kind of the, I'm hearing the same argument from both sides, you just said. And that is sad to me because we're talking about the well-being of our society. That's all of us in this room. So it's like both sides, I think, are suffering some of what you just described.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Let's just see if Jim had, you have any more follow up to that?
Yeah. I mean, it's, this is a good point. You know, there's probably a tax on both sides, but if you're a physician in this country and you disagree, and there's lots of pediatricians, there's a whole organization called Physicians for Informed Consent. Thousands of doctors are involved in standing up and saying, you know, we're not really doing the science. Vaccines have a whole different level and a criteria, a lower level of criteria for safety and clinical studies. Biologics have a special category. Vaccines are given a special pass. They don't have to have tens of thousands of patients followed over years. The hepatitis B vaccine, the preclinical trial that put that vaccine onto the market, was tested on 147 patients, most of which weren't newborns, as it's delivered on the first day of life in almost every hospital to almost every child in America. 99.9% of children are getting a hepatitis B vaccine, a disease of sexually transmitted disease that we screen mothers for. We know that they don't, when they need it and when they don't need it. And 99.9% of kids that are getting it without the need. It's about compliance, not about science. But to finish the point about this low level of science that's being enacted to put these things on the market, the hepatitis B vaccine was tested on 147 children who were followed for 4 days and 5 days in two separate little tiny studies that totaled up 147. Now, in any estimation of science, that is not good science. That is not the way we do things. And then it's so vaccines then become an experiment in the phase four trials where they're just put into the into the population. Yes, ma'am.
And I don't know if you want to respond.
Go ahead. Let our guest, Dirk, ahead and respond to that. And then after you go, Dirk, we're going to cut. We're going to stop for a hard break. But ahead, Dirk.
I've got about 2 minutes.
Yeah, we'll give you about 2 minutes.
All right. Well, on the topic of Vioxx, Jim, you and I know that the main issue with Vioxx was cardiac death. And you also know that in that cohort of patients, almost uniformly, all of them had some sort of cardiac comorbidity. Now, I'm not going to argue anything else about pharma, but I will point out that Dr. Wakefield was indeed funded by pharma in the UK when he did his study, and 10 of his co-authors retracted their participation. So I'm just going to leave that right in there for now. The thing for me regarding safety, I think that has been greatly extended because there's a lot of people who think that there's some sort of conspiracy with big pharma. And I understand that, but...
William Thompson, the CDC researcher that came out and said...
If I may, please. And so here's my point about conspiracy, and I like common sense. The CDC has 10,000, almost 11,000 employees. The NIH has 20,000 employees. The FDA has 14,000 employees. The American Medical Association has 5,000 employees. The World Health Organization here in the United States has 7,000 employees. That's 57,000 people directly involved with the health of people in a country. And when people talk about, you know, big pharma and conspiracy, so my point is 57,000 people are in a conspiracy with the pharmaceutical corporations. And in today's day and age of internet and social media and leaks and jump drives and flash drives, 57,000 people, not one of those people, have come out and said, here's the conspiracy.
Oh, no, far more than one have come out and said there's a conspiracy.
And I'm sorry, I'm not done yet. And
well, so I think you are. So, I mean, you made your point, and it needs a response.
Let's get a little more civil. Hold on.
I wanted to hear that.
You make your notes, Jim. Go ahead, Dirk. Finish
well,
up.
Well, but part of the injury, you know, goes back to the issue of the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act. And what was really important about that is it developed the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, which is voluntary and is not judgmental here in the United States. And it also created the monitoring of vaccine safety. So pre- and post-licensure, the FDA and other organizations test every single lot of vaccines for purity and for safety. And so the issue that there is not safety, that there is not study, when you give to consideration the millions upon millions of dosages that have been administered here in the United States, vaccines are safe. Now, the issue of the science of does it cause something or create some other problem, that is what still has to be answered. And the problem is we're looking at millions of doses of vaccines given in comparison to 5 or 10 or 100 cases of problems.
Okay. I think that's a really good place to stop. Jim, you're going to be first up, I promise you, after the break, because I know there's a lot you want to respond to there. Yeah. I think, Dirk, you gave us a really good background to the summary of that first half of the show. I think we're raising the temperature here, but let's keep a civil discourse.
I think you're going to need to get those gloves.
By the way, that's right. Our guest, I guess our martial artist is Jim, and boxing, right, is Dirk. So we may have to set up some cage fight or something after. But we're going to take a break right here. We're going to talk about our premier sponsor, Elevated Roofing, who's been our sponsor since day one. They do a tremendous job on roofing, especially in North Texas. In fact, I found out the other day, Sherry, that they go all the way down into Dallas. I thought it was just North Texas, but someone recently told me that they had their roof done in Irving or Arlington or somewhere down there. So if you're in the listening audience and you're anywhere in North Texas, probably into Oklahoma too. I'm sure if they go to Oklahoma, right?
Right.
Probably. All the way up to Norman. Who said their child's going to Norman? I think you did, Jim, right?
Yeah, okay. That's right. My youngest daughter.
So I'm sure that Elevated Roofing is doing roofs up at Sooner Boom or Booner Sooner or whatever. So if you need a new roof or even fix your existing roof, I would definitely contact Elevated Roofing. Class people, like I said, besides doing the roof, they do the painting, elevated painting. They do your gutters, elevated gutters.
I always get with the magnet. They use a magnet to get all
right,
the nails.
Right, the magnet that they pick up all the nails after they're done is just tremendous. The service that they provide, the ongoing response. I still get calls from them to ask me how they can improve.
Oh, I couldn't
believe it. So if you do need a roof, please contact James Honeycutt or Kenny Gammons at 469-200-0582. That's 469-200-0582. And it looks like I'm going to talk about our other sponsor, too, because I don't know if we're going to make it the way this show is just moving so quickly. Porsche Plano is our other sponsor. And again, I happen to own a Porsche. So, Dirk, when you were talking about that, but they... The amazing service that Porsche Plano gives is incredible. I looked around at all the different Porsche dealerships around the Metro DFW area. I'm telling you, Porsche Plano, they're the best. You walk in there, they treat you with kid gloves. They have this basket. I talked about in a previous show, they have fruit baskets, all organic, Dr. Jim. So you could go in there, get an organic banana or an apple, and then you sit down and wait for your car. They do full service. They wash your car by hand. Tremendous. And then also, like I mentioned other shows, if you ever want to go there, I know, Jim, you're in from Tulsa, but what they offer, you come in there, you could drive any of their cars, you know, test drive them. And the new Cayman, incredible car. Unbelievable. The new Boxster. Have you ever driven in a Boxster? Those are cool. You're talking about the dating scene before the show, right? I mean,
you need a Porsche. Okay.
Yeah, Porsche would be really good.
I need that edited out.
Sorry.
Oh, no.
Sorry.
No, I'm a Porsche fan as well, too. I own a 1989 Porsche 928
wow.
S4, the risky
Woo!
Business car.
Yes.
Yeah.
But you
nice.
Never let it go into any pond or anything. You make
yeah,
sure. That you
out of my cold, dead hands.
I know. When I saw that Tom Cruise and that Porsche going in the water, I was like, whoa.
So those but I'm not a U-boat commander.
There you go. So those are our two sponsors. Please visit Porsche Plano and Plano on Plano Parkway. See Nikki Curtwright. John Griggs is there. Good people. And please Elevated Roofing. So we are back. We left it with Dirk giving us a whole litany of the reasons why vaccinations have been supported and no conspiracy and we're going to let Jim respond to that. We'll give you a good segment.
All right,
to
10 minutes.
Respond. Not 10 minutes.
No.
Running on, we'll definitely interrupt you. Go ahead, Jim.
I apologize for interrupting you, Dr. Dirk, but let's try to do one topic at a time and then allow response because that long list, you know, it becomes that's kind of a gish gallop through a lot of topics. So let's talk about VAERS for a second. VAERS is loaded with tens of thousands of reports of vaccine injuries. VAERS, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, was a construct that was created to surveil for problems that with adverse events and vaccines, and it was created by that same 1986 National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act. And it is loaded with tens of thousands every year, tens of thousands of adverse events reported. Now, and that's just what is reported. What we know is that the federal agencies commissioned a study of VAERS to see how much was actually being reported. And the estimate is less than 1%, or approximately 1% of all adverse events are being reported to that monitoring system. So if you take the number of vaccine adverse events and you multiply it times 100, we have a big problem in this country. What the pro-vaccine side often does is they diminish the validity of VAERS. They will say, well, anybody can report to that. It can have, non-reviewed things that didn't really happen or may not have happened. That may be true, but that is the system that we created to surveil, and that system is showing a real problem with adverse events, injuries, and even deaths caused by vaccines. So that's item number one. Number two, you said that lots of vaccines are tested. Please tell me, Dr. Rodriguez, you don't believe that, because that's not happening. Not every lot of vaccine is tested. That's the same kind of problems that happened with the Qatar incident that you mentioned can happen and are happening with vaccines today. Lots of vaccines are being recalled after they're being found to cause injuries in the population. It's not pre-market testing, it's market testing. Our children are an experiment in a lot of these cases, and we're finding that there's contaminants, and it's happening. We're finding it because the injuries are already occurring. The argument that you presented, the argument of, well, we've administered millions of vaccines and very few people are, being injured. That's the same argument of the doctors that were supporting cigarettes back in the 1950s and 60s. That's the argument that there were millions of cigarettes being smoked and very few people developed lung cancer or other cancers. We are in tobacco science 2.0 with vaccine science. That's the argument of tobacco science. It can't be accepted. You can't believe that that's the way to argue this point.
So have the vaccines changed since when they were written? Like the basic ones. I know there's like a long list that could be discussed, but I'm talking about the basic ones. Have they changed?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. So the MMR vaccine was, it went to a different, the aborted fetal tissue, it started being grown on aborted fetal cells in 1978. It was brought to market in 1978 with the Stanley Plotkin created new rubella version of the live virus being grown on a line of cells that were derived from aborted fetus. Or it took about 38 fetuses to get that one that was used, and then since then has been grown repetitively.
Yeah, but I thought a lot of them were originated like from the 30s. Is that just the first one?
Well, they all have different origins. Like the some of the more recent vaccines, the Gardasil vaccine is very recent. Since 1986, the number of vaccines that are being administered to our children has more than quadrupled.
I know. I guess I was really just trying to understand, like the five that we've been getting since we were kids.
Right.
Have those not been the exact same thing in the package all this time, guys?
No, they have changed. The MMR vaccine.
Okay. That's what I was trying to understand.
They actually packaged some of the vaccines together, right? Isn't the DTaP like a combination of three vaccines?
Yeah, and it's changed. It's now, we learned that the DTP vaccine, which was causing so many injuries, that it was really the DTP vaccine and the approximately $5 billion worth of potential lawsuits against the pharmaceutical manufacturers of the DTP vaccine that really created the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act. Pharma went to the Congress and said, if you do not give us immunity to liability, if we keep getting sued because our vaccines are harming and killing children, then we're gonna drop out of the market. We can't do this. So they invested a lot of money in paying for the campaigns, donating to campaigns of legislators, and they got this tragic law, the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, that gave them product liability. And that was a point you kind of made, I made, and then you kind of diminished the issue of, does the pharmaceutical industry have product liability? They don't. They pay 75 cents per vaccine, It goes into a fund, and then the federal government decides in a special court, a special magistrate. It's not a real court system. It's not the same kind of a system that you would be able to utilize in a tort-based system.
So, he's raising his hand.
So, Dirk, you can go for sure, but I just do have a question. Do you think, and maybe you put this in your answer, because I'm going to ask a similar question to Jim. So the vaccines that are out there, in your professional opinion, do we need all these vaccines? Do we need to give a child who's born a hepatitis B or the HPV for boys? I mean,
HPV
at 9 years old. So maybe you can incorporate that in some of the things that you can respond to, Jim.
Yeah. One of the things that you've probably heard in this discussion is I keep going back to science. You know, I'm not yelling. I'm not hearing all the shouting, all the screaming and all that other stuff. And so, you know, and getting back to that comment I made regarding Dr. Sagan, the science that we have now is the best we have until better science comes along. And when it comes to vaccine and what's going on with vaccines and the products that are used and how they're formulated and how they're made and how they're giving is constantly evolving, you know, and so that is something that's going to go on forever and ever. And again, it's just part of our nature. Regarding the vaccine adverse event reporting system, the journal Pediatrics in 2015 did a wonderful evaluation of the different events cited, and they found events. But what ended up happening is when they looked into the medical records of those adverse events that they had access to, they realized that there were other problems going on. And I'm not going to go into those details, but the beauty of the VAERS system is that everybody and anybody can report into it. And then it is the duty of the CDC to find out what is the validity of those complaints. So I'm not here to tell you that vaccines do not cause problems. We understand that. That has been documented very well in science that vaccines can have problems. But when you compare that to the millions of lives that have been saved, when you compare that to the millions of dollars that have been saved in hospital care costs, emergency room visit costs, you know, the comparison is millions to hundreds and maybe even thousands. But here's the big thing that I want to come back with to anyone who is against vaccines. Number one, produce reproducible science. Go ahead and do that. You know, I understand you have your point. You've stated vaccines cause problems. Produce reproducible science that's comparative, that we can track back to that, number one. And number two, for those who are anti-vaccine, what is your alternative to vaccine?
Those are great
that
questions.
That is one that I
so
was really...
So let's hear Jim's response. And also, Jim, in your response, like I had a question for Dirk, how do we protect, you know, these vaccines supposedly, you know, from your position, we not necessarily need them, but how do we protect the elderly and the infants that supposedly are the most susceptible to diseases for people that aren't vaccinated around these parts of society?
Well, those are tough questions. And if I had all the answers to that, I would have solved this problem already. But here is the issue. Number one, we need to understand how a lot of these vaccines work. You're not protecting a child from pertussis you're not protecting a child that cannot be immunized or someone that's immunocompromised from a vaccine transmitted disease or a vaccine preventable disease when you give them certain vaccines. The pertussis vaccine does not protect from transmission. It targets a portion of the toxin that is expressed, so it decreases the symptoms. There is an argument to be made that in vaccinating with pertussis, whooping cough, the vaccine for whooping cough, you may actually be creating a large army of asymptomatic carriers that are not presenting with symptoms, so they don't self-quarantine, and so they are capable of transmitting that disease to a child that's too young to receive that vaccine. There are a number of vaccines that are in this category. The meningococcal vaccine is also an asymptomatic carrying vaccine. They don't all work the same way. We also have to recognize that a lot of the live virus vaccines are capable of causing the infection themselves. So the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine is a live virus vaccine. We know that from the 2015 outbreak of measles at Disneyland, that 38% of the CDC's PCR polymerase chain reaction DNA analysis of the cause of those cases, 38% of those cases were vaccine strain of the measles. So we know that the measles vaccine can cause a type of measles. It can cause, and a lot of those cases of measles are outbreaks caused by the vaccine themselves. That's from the CDC's own science. I'll leave it there. It looks like Dirk might want to respond to some of that.
No, I really
do you agree?
I do not agree with that because, again, you haven't answered the question. Number one, no reproducible comparative science. Number two, you haven't provided an alternative, which is one of the things I said. What is the alternative other than not providing vaccines?
That's what I want
to
know.
And it's not just the issue of avoidance of it's not the issue. We're not trying to avoid transmission. What we're trying to do is trying to keep people from suffering the complications of the disease process, which are significant. And I hate using anecdotes or anything like that, but unless you've seen a person or a child die from measles-related pneumonia or encephalitis, it's horrifying. And it's not just the disease process and the death itself, because comparatively, when you look at the rate of death or the incidence of death throughout the general population, it's clear that those deaths from vaccine-preventable diseases are low, but it's also the possible sequela, meaning the kids who are left with neurologic deficits, auditory deficits, whatever. You know, I'm not going to discuss that. But again, what I want as a scientist is give me the alternative. What is your alternative to this horrendous vaccine situation that has been posed as a huge public health risk?
Okay. Yeah. I'll answer those two questions. So number one, how to prevent. I think that's what we need to focus on is the prevention of the disease. Number one, we've already done that. Most diseases in this country were eliminated by better hygiene, cold storage of food, you know, better plumbing. You're kind of biased from a world in which I understand you were trained in Puerto Rico. You did the tropical medicine thing. You've seen a lot of third world countries in which they don't have these things that have done more to reduce these vaccine-preventable diseases than vaccines ever will. Vaccines are riding on the coattail of those improvements in hygiene and otherwise. To prevent it here, one of the things that we've got to do is we've got to get the glyphosate out of our food. We got to get the glyphosate is the active ingredient in Roundup. It's contaminating far too much of our food. It's disrupting the gut microbiome. We need to get vitamin D levels up. We need to just simply improve nutrition.
Food coloring out.
So you're saying if we're healthier, live better lives, that we don't need vaccines? Is that your position?
That is absolutely one of the positions. And specifically, we know that they're trying to create a universal vaccine for flu. And that universal vaccine looks a lot like vitamin D. It works at the base of the viral causes. And bringing vitamin D levels up is a great.
And there are
way
a lot
prevent.
Of people that believe that, Sherry. I know you had that look, but a lot of
well,
people.
Well, no,
believe in
this
health.
Is what the look was for. I can assure you, you take away vaccines, and people like my mother cannot be in public. I mean, it's just a reality. So, and I get it. I get it. I do. I think this conversation is so needed from both sides, and it needs to be happening in a more responsible pace. But no, I'm sorry. No, if you're immune compromised and you and this happens on a level that is across the country, you are automatically 86ing a certain amount of our society. Now, I do understand that with having them in place to some degree, we're also 86ing another portion of society. That's why I think this is a much needed conversation by both sides.
Well, the first thing you need to understand about being immunocompromised, I would argue that they're at a greater risk of receiving a disease that is transmitted by a live virus. There are far, 95%.
She's susceptible to that. So why would we not control the things we can control?
Well, so you can control her exposure to the people that are transmitting a live virus, after they get vaccinated. When they get vaccinated with a live virus vaccine, they are capable of shedding and transmitting that virus. She's at a much greater risk from the recently vaccinated by a live virus vaccine than she is from an unvaccinated child or adult that cannot transmit a disease that they don't have. That's a critical point that people need to understand.
Derek, you want to
respond
to that?
He's like, what am I doing here? Sorry.
I'm sorry. I'm looking for the aluminum foil.
I don't think we talked about that yet, but go ahead.
Well, what you're talking about is preventive. I understand that. But when polio was at its height here in the United States, the polio vaccine, it pretty much almost created the drive-through window. because what you're talking about is isolation. And when the polio seasons would hit up, cities, towns, villages would refuse to interact with other people for the fear of polio. And when people would go to a store to purchase something, they would crack open the door and hand it to somebody without touching them, or they would hand it out through a window. You know, so isolation is not prevention. That is not prevention. And the other thing, to Sherry's point that she said so passionately but probably couldn't be heard, is that the reduction of deaths, of millions of deaths in the United States and throughout the world because of vaccines. Now, I believe in preventive medicine, but we do have to accept that the presence of vaccines and the presence of medicine has created longevity here, particularly in first world countries. And if it's that bad, why is the World Health Organization, the United Nations, pushing so hard to push these type of therapies and treatments into third world countries? Because they do have an impact. But again, I am not hearing a viable alternative to save millions of lives, and not just saves lives from deaths, but to prevent the complications of diseases that we've been working on since, you know, the 1700s. And since the 1900s, we've been working on vaccines.
Okay, Jim, do you want to respond to that?
Oh, yeah. So first and foremost, the science has not been done to determine that you know, vaccines are not increasing the rate of morbidity and mortality in the population. Well, actually, it has been done. It's been done by Peter A. Abey, who is a 40-year researcher, a physician that has been providing vaccines to third world countries in Africa and Guinea-Bissau. And he came out in March of this year saying that the DPT vaccine is killing children at a rate that's 2.3 times higher than the age match populations. He's one of the first vaccinated versus unvaccinated studies that he was able to do on data that he had acquired in treating hundreds of thousands of children in Guinea-Bissau. And if you look up Peter A. Abey, A-A-B-Y, March 9th, he was at a consortium talking about this problem with science that we have in the United States today. And he says the DPT vaccine we have now determined is killing children, preferentially females, at a higher rate that's 2.3 times age-matched controls. So they're dying because this inactivated vaccine, we've now got substantive data is showing, is those children are dying from other disease processes. One of the things that is very complicated that people are not, you know, hearing enough about is that vaccinations, when we're injecting viruses, you know, multiple species of cells, aluminum adjuvants into the tissues of our children, it's changing the immune system. It's changing the immune system in a way that is shifting us to a more autoimmune and an inflammatory and allergic response system. And so gluten. You have here in the United States today,
gluten.
Well, it's, you know, and with gluten comes glyphosate.
That's
and a lot of other things.
But
it's multifactorial, but you can trace it directly to the vaccines. There's epidemiologic data that shows inflection points where there's an increase in the incidence of disease processes, adverse events associated with the introduction of a new vaccine, such as the 1978 MMR vaccine. But I don't want to get off this point about how we're shifting the immune system, how it's changing the health and creating an autoimmune and inflammatory reaction, which has left the United States with more children dying on the first day of life, the first year, and the first 5 years of life. We have the worst infant mortality rate in the world. We're worse than many third world countries.
And you attribute that to the vaccines?
I think we have to look at it. I think it's multifactorial, but one of the things that is universally being provided to our children is vaccinations. We have 54% of children in the United States today that are suffering from one or more of 21 chronic diseases. And nobody can figure out what's causing it. We're looking everywhere, but nobody wants to really look at vaccines.
I have a question for Dr. Dirk. What about the politics that sometimes surrounds a lot of this conversation? For example, 2007, was it, or 2007 with Rick Perry mandating
right,
the HPV. Do you think that a lot of what kind of muddies the water in your job could be the fact that sometimes politics does get intertwined into something that's more of a serious issue? Because quite honestly, it causes distrust. For, you know, for
and
your...
And to parlay on that, because I know you're going to respond, do people have a choice for themselves? Do you believe that it should be mandated by the state? As a previous show, we had that on a previous show. I'll let you add those two together.
Well, the I never believe that celebrities or politicians solve anything. Okay, but that
great
can be a
answer
different,
to start. Go
you
ahead.
Know, that can be a completely different topic. And on the topic of HPV... I think that that was a knee-jerk reaction, again, created by a lot of screaming people.
Okay.
And so, again, I have yet to hear an alternative.
What about mandating, though? Do you think that the public should be mandated to have these vaccines?
Well, here's the issue regarding public health. What we need to understand is when individuals congregate in the public, if there is some sort of risk that has been identified, then I believe that there should be circumstances where we have to mandate for the overall public safety, just as Jim talked about, you know, in preventive medicine, clean water, other hygiene issues. There are some things that we do have to mandate. And I believe that's for the greater good of the safety. But by the same token, vaccines and the studies regarding vaccines since the 1900s have shown a greater good. And the anti-vaccine faction has not provided a good alternative that's going to match those type of numbers.
All right, Jim, I'll give you a minute or so to tell us why, you know, what your point is against that.
Yeah, we're not going to get a better alternative until we hold the pharmaceutical companies, the vaccine manufacturers, accountable for their products. Right now, there is no incentive for them to produce a better, safer vaccine. When they can invest 5 cents in a cheap adjuvant instead of $5 in a safer, better adjuvant, they have no incentive to do that. And that's something we have to recognize. Politics is the problem here. It's how politics has supervened the scientific process and has given an entire industry liability from the injuries that their products cause. When we don't have that in place, when we fail to recognize the financial bias that is involved in so many of the decision makings, vaccination is a profitable process for a pediatric clinic. They'll argue that it's not, but they're not arguing from the fact that vaccine wellness visits are vaccine visits. Children and parents are being coerced now with these mandates and threats of mandates to, you know, walk to their march to their pediatrician office to get vaccinated.
But is that something we hold the vaccines responsible for, or do we hold that individual physician responsible? I mean, we have bad teachers. Not all of them are amazing. We have bad parents. Not all of them are amazing. So can
bad
we not? Yeah. Can we not just say that's just a bad doctor?
They're equally culpable. They have to both be held accountable. If pediatricians and vaccine doctors were more accountable for the injuries that the interventions that they're providing cause, There might be a much better informed consent process. They might actually be more careful in making sure that they describe the full risks, benefits, and alternatives of vaccinations in pediatrician offices.
I'll give you 30 seconds, Dirk.
So very quickly, the individual and the parent are certainly responsible for what they can do, and there is no law.
Oh, that's kind of good.
You know, there is no law that states that the person has to receive the vaccine at a certain time. There's a recommendation vaccination schedule. But parents are very free to alter that, and they can talk that over with their pediatrician. You know, so it's up to the individual and to the parents.
Okay, do you want to respond?
Well, they're not. In more and more states, New York right now is undergoing a vaccine mandate crisis. California is way down that road now. So it's not, they're not free. They're coerced by government mandates to receive a vaccine that could injure or kill their child.
But no one has dragged those parents in
I was going to say, we got a lot of...
Anyway. I think that's where we're going to have to end it. Unfortunately, I'd like to get these guests back again. I think we could have gone for another hour.
Oh,
on this,
I could.
But we'll see how that works out. But thank you so much to our guest today, Dr. Dirk Rodriguez and Dr. Jim Meehan coming in from Tulsa. Good luck to you, Dirk, on your move. I won't say where you're moving to, but good luck to you. I don't want people following you.
Guinea-Bissau.
But thank you so much, everybody, for coming. Thanks for our sponsors, Elevated Roofing, Porsche Plano. Thank you, everybody in our studio audience.
My lovely wife over there.
There you go. Thanks for making the trip. And we'll see you next Thursday, 8 o'clock. Thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your day.